This is Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Helena de Groot. Today, the eternal present. When James Wright was 30, he got a very special magazine in the mail. Right on the cover, it had a drawing of a knight on horseback carrying a spear, with birds flying overhead, in a style that I can only describe as Aztec-influenced. And in big boxy letters, it said, The 50s, a magazine of poetry and general opinion. The man behind this magazine was Robert Bly, who wanted to shake things up in the world of poetry and mailed every person in that year's New Poets anthology a copy. For James Wright, this surprise magazine could not have arrived at a better time. He had just won the Yale Younger Poets Prize for his first collection, The Green Wall, but he was being eaten up by doubt. He couldn't explain to anyone why, but the book stank, according to him. It was written by a dead man. I met up with James Wright's biographer, Jonathan Blunk, who starts his book, James Wright, A Life in Poetry, by telling this story of the magazine that would change James Wright's life.
I think what's fascinating about Robert Bly's magazine in the 50s and then the 60s is its inclusiveness of world literatures. Bly's impetus in starting that magazine was to publish a lot of the poets that weren't getting their way into the established poetry journals. He announced in the first issue of the 50s, and it's a phrase that struck James Wright dumb when he first picked up the magazine, was the editors of this magazine believe that all the poetry written today is too old-fashioned. There's a way in which Bly felt that the great poetry of Latin America, of Spain, of Germany, the poets in these countries were making great inroads that American poets hadn't yet really experienced. There wasn't a tradition of translation that we see coming in the 1960s, and the 50s is very much a part of starting what has become common practice for poets today, to look to other poetic traditions and other languages to get inspiration for their own work. And he writes to Robert Bly for the first time after receiving a copy of the 50s magazine in the mail. And he recognizes intuitively that in writing to Bly, he's opening up communications with a like-minded poet, but also opening up a part of himself that he had been kind of frightened to explore in his own work.
Well, I thought the first thing that we could do, I didn't want to go through the biography sort of, chronologically beat by beat.
Sure.
But I would like to start with his childhood. And I was just wondering, what would be the single most important thing that you feel like people should know to understand the man?
Well, his childhood and the first, say, 18 years of his life that he spent in Martin's Ferry are really crucial for his entire poetic career, really, because that's a grounding for his imagination. He never wanted to go back to his hometown after he left, and he only visited there very briefly once he joined the army. But even when he's traveling in Europe in the last decade of his life, he's constantly going back to Martin's Ferry and the people he knew, the people he admired. And that's a wellspring for his poems, really. So it's a really troubled kind of relationship that he had with his hometown. And yet the great natural beauty of the Ohio River is a presence that he felt that never left him.
Yeah. And can you talk a little bit about, at some point, I think he calls it a ravaged place.
Yes.
Can you describe that landscape?
Sure. So the Ohio River, it's about a quarter mile wide, say, where he grew up, right on the river. Martin's Ferry is directly across the river from Wheeling, West Virginia. And this is a steel town, a coal town, as so many Ohio Valley towns were based on industry. And so they attracted a huge influx of population from Europe, from all over the South. There were jobs. And he grew up during the Depression. So there was a lot of poverty, and yet there was a lot of industrial bustle. You know, the word ravaged applies to, this was a very naturally beautiful place. There are steep hills on both sides. So the Appalachians, that's the northern range of the mountains there. Mm. So coal mining and steel making are notoriously filthy operations. And so the whole natural beauty of the place was desolated by the coal soot and the pollution in the river. And this touched him very deeply.
Yeah, and his dad, I think he made the lids for mason jars, right?
Correct, yeah. His father began work when he was 14 years old, leaving school.
Wow.
And worked for 50 years on an assembly line.
Mm-hmm. So, and his mother worked at a laundromat, I think?
That's right. A laundry, an industrial laundry.
What does that mean? What is that?
This would be huge ironing presses. It would be closer to working in an industrial conveyor line. Mm. I mean, this was like a huge factory, essentially, where what they did was clean and launder and iron.
That sounds incredibly hard work.
His mother was very happy to be married and to leave that behind.
Yeah. Yeah, and so you just mentioned that Martin's Ferry had such an enormous influx of immigrants from all over. So there must have been a lot of languages or at least accents sort of floating around in the air, too.
That's very true. He said late in his life when he was recollecting his childhood, he said, I remember the affections of those words. He's speaking of the multiple language of the different communities. Mm. Whether it was Hungarian or Greek or Polish or Russian, all of this huge conglomerate of languages attracted him. He was gifted in hearing mm-hmm. languages. He had a phenomenal, phenomenal memory. And he always spoke of languages as a kind of music that you heard.
Yeah. I want to go a little more into that, you know, that incredible ear and memory that he had. But first, I'd like to get to a poem where that really double relationship with, you know, his hometown, it becomes clear.
Sure.
I was thinking of this poem called Beautiful Ohio.
Yes.
Which he wrote pretty late in his life. It's from 76, I think.
It's difficult for me sometimes to read the poems because I can see some of the earlier drafts that are standing behind them. And this was a much longer poem that he finally just excised an entire couple of pages before we get to this part. So mm-hmm. it begins almost in the middle of things. He's remembering the Native Americans who lived along the Ohio River in the town that he grew up in that area of Ohio. Beautiful Ohio. Those old Winnebago men knew what they were singing. All summer long and all alone, I had found a way to sit on a railroad tie above the sewer main. It spilled a shining waterfall out of a pipe somebody had gouged through the slanted earth. 16,500 more or less people in Martin's Ferry, my home, my native country, quickened the river with the speed of light, and the light caught there the solid speed of their lives in the instant of that waterfall. I know what we call it most of the time, but I have my own song for it, and sometimes, even today, I call it beauty.
I love those last lines. Sometimes, even today, I call it beauty, sitting on a sewer main.
What's wonderful about this poem and so many of the poems he wrote late in his life about Martin's Ferry is that he had not been back to his hometown mm. in decades. He, mm. The last time he stepped foot in Martin's Ferry would have been in 1958. The marvelous thing about these poems and many of his famous poems, even Autumn Begins in Martin's Ferry, Ohio, one of his most anthologized poems, he's recollecting the place and the people. He's not actually in that poem sitting in a football stadium watching a football game. He's remembering what it was like. And yet it's occurring in the present tense, like in this poem, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes even today.
Yes.
Call it beauty, but he's sitting in New York working in his notebook. So there's a way in which there's an eternal present that is the place of Martin's Ferry and its people that he can tap into, that nourished his poems throughout his life.
Yeah, and I really love what you said about that sort of eternal present, you know, that it seems as if he's sitting right there. And I have a sense that he didn't do that always already, that that is something that came as a shift in his poetry in the late 50s.
I agree.
What happened?
When he first started writing poems, let's say he was 10 or 11 years old, he fell in love with the Romantics, John Keats and William Blake. And he began actually studying Latin in high school. So these were highly refined and rhymed and metered poems that he came to understand as a kind of bedrock of what poetry could be. And in adolescence, in high school, he realized that in order to get out of Martin's Ferry, he was desperate to leave the place, that education was going to be his way out. And the only way he could afford it would be to join the army on the GI Bill and go to school. So from Japan, he applied to Kenyon College and was accepted, which is just 100 miles or so from his hometown in Martin's Ferry. And John Crow Ransom was there. He became a protege of John Crow Ransom. And so that idea of a poem, and especially from his translations he did from Latin, that was his idea of what a poem was. Mm-hmm. And certainly in the 1950s, that was what poetry meant to everyone. There wasn't necessarily the same... the 60s was a very large shift towards free verse. I mean, we had Whitman, of course, but Whitman wasn't much read in the 1950s.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. James Wright kind of fought his way through a lot of the assumed standards of the time to see a new way to write his poems.
When you say fought his way through, what does that mean?
I think he recognized that not enough of his life was finding its way into his poetry.
Uh-huh.
That by writing in rhyme and meter and using the formal elements that he came to have great facility with, uh-huh, still left out a lot of his emotional life, a lot of his interactions with other people. And he started reading more widely in other poetic traditions. When you speak of that eternal present, that moment, what I remembered when you focused on that was his readings of translations of Chinese poetry,
mm-hmm,
where the great classical Chinese poets of the Tang Dynasty, that was where the poem takes place, in that present moment. And that became really important to him. And a lot of the breakthrough poems that we find in his Watershed volume, The Branch Will Not Break, that he publishes in 1963, you'll see that so many of those poems are focused, you know, in the present, and that was in itself, mm-hmm, a great shift. He wasn't recollecting something, even though, as we can see in Beautiful Ohio, he's projecting himself into a presence that is not necessarily where he happens to be sitting at the time. But.
Right. I'm just wondering if we can sort of read two poems, you know, one next to the other, one from right before and one, uh-huh, from right after that great,
certainly,
breakthrough. I was,
yeah,
thinking we could read My Grandmother's Ghost,
sure,
which he wrote in 1956.
Yeah.
And then I have three poems for after, just before A Thunder Shower, A Blessing and Miners.
Great. So this is... this is a sonnet that James Wright read more often than any other poem in his readings throughout his life, even in the final reading that he gave in the months before he died. His grandmother meant everything to him when he was growing up. She was a kind of confederate of his ne'er-do-well activities, skipping school, and he loved her very much. The poem kind of takes place in the graveyard where his grandmother was buried. It's called My Grandmother's Ghost. She skimmed the yellow water like a moth, trailing her feet across the shallow stream. She saw the berries, paused and sampled them, where a slight spider cleaned his narrow tooth. Light in the air, she fluttered up the path, so delicate to shun the leaves and damp, like some young wife holding a slender lamp to find her stray child, or the moon, or both. Even before she reached the empty house, she beat her wings ever so slightly, rose, followed a bee where apples blew like snow, and then, forgetting what she wanted there, too full of blossom and green light to care, she hurried to the ground and slipped below.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it is so pleasing, right? This sonnet rhythm and then this rhyme, you know,
It's the music of the language that becomes kind of intoxicating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can totally see why he would choose to read this, or he didn't really read, he remembered and then...
That's true. In fact, it's kind of fascinating. There was Philip Levine told me an anecdote where before a reading, he asked Phil Levine for one of his books, one of James Wright's books before the reading. And Phil said, well, I'm sorry, I have all your books at my office. He said, it doesn't matter. Just give me any book. He just wanted to have a prop so that people in the audience wouldn't be put off by the fact that he was reciting all these poems from memory.
I love that. That he has this exquisite skill, but he doesn't want to weird people out with it.
That's right.
Oh, and... Yeah, I'd love for you to read a poem where we can see sort of that shift in that new form inspired by, you know, those modernist poets, European poets, Latin American poets, by Chinese poetry. And you pick. I mean, I chose a few as suggestions, but if there's another one that you think is better.
So let me try this poem. This is from 1961. It's called Miners. The police are dragging for the bodies of miners in the black waters of the suburbs. Below, some few crawl, searching, until they clasp the fingers of the sea. Somewhere, beyond tipples and drowsing woodchucks, a strong man alone beats on the door of a grave, crying, "Oh, let me in." Many women mount long stairs into the shafts and emerge in the tottering palaces of abandoned cisterns. In the middle of the night, I can hear cars moving on steel rails, colliding underground.
Thank you. Can you help me point to a few moments in this poem where you really feel like that new way of writing emerges?
What we notice immediately is the varying line lengths that Wright becomes incredibly skilled at. There's a way in which the emotional tenor of the poem becomes more open by the way in which the images are highlighted and form a focal point for our attention in the poem. In the final stanza, we have, in the middle of the night break, I can hear cars moving on steel rails, colliding. There's a line break there. And the final line is one word, underground. He was a master at the conclusions of poems, and we often remember the endings of many of his poems. There's a way in which the poems are opening out at the end of the poem. I think that's one of the key techniques that I think have become subsumed in our common practice of poetry. I think a lot of what we read in James Wright's poems at the time they first appeared was somewhat radical, and a lot of poets were really struck by that book, The Branch Will Not Break, because a lot of the techniques have become common practice for us in poetry. Were very new and startling at the time.
There's this poem, Beginning, where I feel like that thing that you say about those very short, like little bits on one line is even more dramatic. Would you mind reading that one too?
Oh, sure. This is another poem from The Branch Will Not Break. And it's one of the few poems that appears in James Wright's journal exactly as it appears on the page in the published form. He didn't alter one word or one line break or it was one of those, what he spoke of as a gift, mm-hmm. that the fact that this poem appeared in his journal exactly as we see it published is really quite miraculous. It's a poem called Beginning. The moon drops one or two feathers into the field. The dark wheat listens. Be still. Now. There they are, the moon's young, trying their wings. Between trees, a slender woman lifts up the lovely shadow of her face. And now she steps into the air. Now she is gone, wholly into the air. I stand alone by an elder tree. I do not dare breathe or move. I listen. The wheat leans back towards its own darkness, and I lean toward mine. What we see immediately is that he's finding his way into nature, really, to find some solace, some way out of the sense of entrapment and longing that was so much of his life at the time when he was living in Minneapolis. His marriage was failing. He was drinking heavily, and he was taking refuge on Robert Bly's farm. It's about 3.5 hours. Mm. He would take a bus out and spend weekends on the Bly farm. Mm. And this is one of those poems that came from that miraculous place where he found a retreat.
Yeah, it's, you know, those parts in your biography were really hard to read, you know, especially in the beginning of the book where we haven't been with him for so long, right?
Yeah.
And then you write really clearly about the ways in which his marriage was not a pleasant one for neither Liberty or James. And I found it so hard to read because you see also, I mean, I haven't met either of them, of course, and so it's unfair for any of us to judge, but... Mm. Yeah, you just, as a woman especially, had this feeling like, oh, there she is. Like, she takes a job as a nurse and she makes all the money in the household. Mm-hmm. I mean, he pays for his tuition in the beginning of their marriage, but that's right. Sort of what his income covers. And she does the heavy lifting. Plus, she cares for both of the kids.
That's true.
Plus, she does the household chores. Plus, she drives him around. He can't drive.
Right.
And I just got so angry with him, you know? And I had to put the book down because I thought, I can't read 500 pages about this man who wants women to take care of him, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering what that was like for you to...
The difficulty for me was seeing the toll that it took on the two children, especially.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed Liberty many times, and I'm grateful to her for all of the photographs and all of the memories that she shared. But it's very clear, even from the very beginning of their marriage, that it was a terrible idea. They were both desperate to leave Martin's Ferry, and somehow they latched onto each other as a way to get out of the Ohio Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And once they had made that escape, there was the marriage just really didn't have much to stand on. And James Wright's drinking, as it became worse when he was in Minneapolis, took a brutal toll on the whole family.
Mm-hmm.
But what I feel is really important to understand is that James Wright was not like the rest of us. He was so enraptured. He was so involved with poetry. Poetry was his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
That's really something that's difficult to understand in the way that we can... It feels like we can more compartmentalize our artistic pursuits,
yeah.
and our daily lives and the demands of our, you know, just the way we have to get through the day. James Wright was not talented with the skills of the everyday, and it wasn't so much that he was looking for women to take care of him, although he was fairly successful at finding the help he needed. It was that if he had to choose between poetry and anything else, poetry was always going to win out. He was that devoted to the art. It wasn't just about his own poetry. It wasn't about making a name for himself. It was just a sheer enthrallment to an ecstasy that he found in words and a love of language. That was what sustained him. That's what made it possible for him to get from one day to the next.
Yeah. Yeah, there. I mean, and that is, I think, in over the course of your biography, which is the sort of the sheer accumulation of that, you know, where you see him time and time again sort of choose poetry and be saved by it, you know, that that really wins you over to him. And in the end, you know, even though, yeah, I, you know, I wouldn't like to be married to him, but then, you know, that's also not needed. I can just read his poems, you know. I mean, and I'm just sort of there's these moments where friends of his sort of remember his intense ways, you know, fondly. I mean, with an exasperated fondness, you know.
Right. That's right.
And I'm thinking of Cy Wiseman, who I think he boarded with at Kenyon.
They were roommates in his final year at Kenyon.
And Wiseman says to you, it's as if he had a piano roll in his head. Once you start pumping it up, it just rolls out by itself and continues to play until it gets to the end of the roll, which might be a day and a half later.
It's true. Part of his great memory, part of the uses he put it to, let's say, is a way to be in social dimensions that made him uncomfortable. Mm. So he took refuge in his ability to recite poems and to entertain in that way, where he could kind of withhold himself and yet put the poems forward. We're not talking about he wouldn't be reciting his own poems, by the way. He would be reciting Latin poems or German poems or anything from the great, you know, from Yeats to Whitman to, I mean, he knew thousands and thousands and thousands of poems and prose too.
Yeah,
chapters of Dickens and Mencken and Mark Twain. He loved Huckleberry Finn and taught the book numerous times.
Yeah, that I think was the thing that most astounded me about his memory, because poems, especially of an earlier day when things still rhymed and stuff, you know, they're made for being remembered, right? So, you know, if you hear them enough, they kind of catch into your ear like a song. But prose isn't written like that. And there's this one great anecdote, I think, of where he sits in the car with, I can't remember who with, and he's reciting Leviathan.
That's right. It was with Robert Haas.
Uh-huh.
It was in a snowstorm in Buffalo, and they were kind of crawling through town in a car. And Robert Haas, who was then in graduate school, remembers him reciting Hobbes's Leviathan. But again, it was a way where James, if he felt uncomfortable, he could kind of take center stage and yet kind of hide behind that.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, there's this diagnosis, right, that at some point a psychiatrist that I think his first wife, Liberty, sort of, you know, convinces him to go see. Mm-hmm. The psychiatrist comes up with a diagnosis, and it was one that I'd never heard of before. Perseveration?
Yes.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I'm not sure how practical it is, except that it seems to hit one particular nail very much on the head, where once he kind of got his teeth into something, he wouldn't let it go until it was finished. And the downside of that is he kind of worked himself into a nervous breakdown in the spring of 1959, in part. His marriage was failing, and he was living outside the home in a kind of rented room. But he was working on translations. He was the whole calendar year of 1959. He wrote very few of his own poems, but he was translating voraciously, teaching himself Spanish. He was fluent in German, and yet he was working on Neruda and Cesar Vallejo, the great Peruvian poet, and Juan Ramón Jiménez, the great Spanish poet, Antonio Machado, all of these poets, he was translating. Sometimes 15 different poems might be at work on any given day. And he literally worked himself into a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
But this is the spade work, in a sense, that made possible that great breakthrough book that comes 4 years later as The Branch Will Not Break.
How did it change your relationship to James Wright to write this biography?
Oh, that's a good question. I felt very, very blessed by this opportunity, not just meeting the poets who were friends of his that he knew and who knew him, but I learned so much from James Wright. Reading the books that were important to him, watching the evolution of his poems, the drafts, the many, many, many drafts of poems that it would take for him to complete a piece. The most wonderful part of the book for me was having access to his journals and seeing, especially at the end of his life, when in the last 2 or 3 years of his life, when he gets sober and is working in prose as well as in poetry, he was literally trying to teach himself to write good, clear English prose. And I think maybe he had ambitions, had he lived, to write in prose more. But it's wonderful to see his journal pages that, especially in the last journey that he took to Europe in 1979, when he was there for 9 months, it's absolutely miraculous that the quality of the work that he achieved in the time he spent in Europe. When he comes home and when he arrives back in New York City in September of 79, he's already beginning to feel ill, and he passes away just 6 months later. And I think had he lived, I think he may. There was his wife Annie, his second wife, spoke of a sheaf that he was carrying around with him where he was speculating about writing a novel. So we don't know what would have come.
Yeah. What happened to those pages?
He destroyed some things before he died.
So he knew that he was about to...
He knew how sick he was, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. You never met him, right?
I did not meet him. I had written to him to do an interview when he returned from Europe in that fall of 1979. I was an undergraduate finishing work at Cornell, and I was writing an honors thesis on his translations from the Spanish. And I had met Robert Bly, and Robert had encouraged me to write to James. But that interview was postponed, and so I think that the energy of having missed that opportunity to meet him is part of what fueled my fascination with tracking him down.
I love that. That is just frustration that fueled you.
It wasn't just that, but it was part of it.
What was the other part? What made you spend so? How much time did you spend on this book?
It was probably close to 20 years that I was focused solely on this project. And it was glorious, really. There's not a moment I spent in his company that I regretted. And that was the great joy of researching the book, was interviewing all of our great poets who were friends of James Wright. James Wright was beloved, and his death was a great shock to the poetry community.
Yeah, that's so beautiful also. You already touched on that, but that when he was asked to give a reading, that he would always start with other people's poems.
That's right. And sometimes he would read more poems by other poets than he would of his own poems.
Yeah. And sometimes, I mean, even to the great chagrin of the organizers, he would read none of his own.
That's right. That's right.
I've been to a lot of poetry readings, and I've never once encountered any poet reading anything by anyone else. I mean, it's
that
so
is criminal.
Rare.
I've said this before at some of the readings for the biography and elsewhere, that I think poets should be obligated to read a poem by some other poet at the beginning of their readings, because we're part of a long tradition.
Yeah.
And this was something that he deeply felt. What else can we ask for in our lives than to enjoy the work, to share the work with other people, and to try to get some good work done ourselves?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's one last fragment that I wanted to get to, which is not a poem. It's a fragment from his diary, which he wrote in Italy. And I was wondering if you could introduce it somehow before you read it. To me, it reads almost like a sort of, like the essence of life for him or something.
I'm so glad you chose this. In the editing of the book, I fought very hard to keep this passage. It touches upon his first great love of romantic poetry when he was a child, when he first discovers poetry. And so there's something very much at stake here. But this is a complete passage from his notebooks written in January 1973. And I'll just read it. Every poet ought to visit the grave of John Keats at this Protestant cemetery in Rome. I don't mean for Keats's sake, for Christ's sake. I mean for the poet's sake. Whatever may have happened to you in the past, and whoever you are, and however you hope to go on living, you take forever to find the grave that doesn't even have Keats's name on it. The tough little bastard got his work done. Never mind his work. You don't mind it when you stand there and know he is in the ground. You know that the best thing to do is to get your work done. You are going to die, too, just like John Keats. I don't know why it is. I have nothing flowery to say about the graveyard. Shelley is there, and Goethe's son, and all kinds of professional Italians. What I like best is the cafe just across the street from the phony pyramid of Cestius, where at least you can get a cheap cup of tea. I don't want to die, not even just like John Keats. I want to live my own life, though, just as he did, the little Cockney hellraiser. So, the tough little bastard got his work done. Never mind his work. It's not about, I think what he's pointing to is your commitment in the moment, in from day to day. It's for him, being a poet wasn't something that you did on weekends or when you found time, or this is something that Edgar Doctorow noticed when they were in college together at Kenyon, was that James Wright was a poet every moment of the day. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something that he even had much choice about. He was constantly revising work. He was constantly working on translations. I can think of three different poets just off the top of my head who spoke of him as the poet. I'm thinking of Robert Bly and Louis Simpson and Philip Levine. Each said that same thing to me, almost verbatim. Mm-hmm. James Wright was the poet. He was, if you met him, you wouldn't forget him. He was probably reciting a poem at the time. It didn't matter to him where it came from, if it was just one good line or if it was, you know, Christina Rossetti or Edna St. Vincent Millay. It didn't matter to him. If it was a good poem, he wanted to cherish it, and he would press it upon people. He would say, you have to read this poem. You haven't read this poem. You have to hear. It wasn't something else that he did. It was all that he did. That's one reason I chose to call the biography A Life in Poetry, because if anyone lived their life in poetry, it was James Wright.
Jonathan Blunk is the author of James Wright, A Life in Poetry, which came out in 2017, and one of the editors of a collection of James Wright's letters, published as A Wild Perfection, which came out in 2005. James Wright was the author of more than 10 books of poetry, among which The Branch Will Not Break from 63, Shall We Gather at the River, 67, Collected Poems, for which he won the Pulitzer in 72, To a Blossoming Pear Tree, 77, and This Journey, which he wouldn't live to see in print. He died in New York in March of 1980, at the age of 52. To find out more about James Wright, check out the Poetry Foundation website, where you can read over 50 of his poems and a dozen of his book reviews. The music in this episode is by Todd Sikafoos. I'm Helena de Groot, and this was Poetry Off the Shelf. Thank you for listening.